Take two.
Take two. Okay, the reason why we're doing take two is we have already recorded the What the History we are about to present to you, our wonderful audience. But unfortunately, this particular program we had didn't really want to play.
I think it was also the entire computer. It was major technical shenanigans of the worst variety.
Shenanigans, I say!
Shenanigans indeed. So
this is our take two. So hopefully this works and we can present and bring to you this two wonderful pieces of weird stuff that has happened in history.
Indeed. I think we should. So, let's get on with it, shall we?
Shall we?
We shall.
Shall we? You said we.
Unless it didn't say poo.
You said poo. Oh, we're so mature here. It's a Sunday afternoon and we're very mature.
And we've already done this before. So it's
like... All right, let's do it again.
What the?
History.
Hello and welcome to What the History, your podcast with bits of bizarre history to make you say, what the history?
What the, indeed.
I am Trevor Holland.
And I am Susie Holland.
And what glorious, bizarre bit of history do you have for us this time around?
All right, for our first one since going...
A while.
Yeah, and before I start off, we hope everyone is happy, healthy, and keeping very, very safe during this time. And, you know, all other times as well.
Yes.
And because we love you. Mwah, love all our peoples around the world.
Indeed we do.
Because we reach pretty much everywhere. I reckon if you played us in Antarctica, you could, you know, you played Spotify in Antarctica, you could hear us. And I'll stop waffling.
We've already got the waffle.
Oh, this is waffle part two.
This is post-opening music waffle.
Okay, all right, I'll stop. Okay, mourning a loved one isn't easy. And if you're mourning a loved one in the 17th century, right up to the 1900s in parts of England, Ireland, Scotland or Wales, a certain very important person in the mourning ritual got a bit of eating in, and I'm not talking about the wake. Enter the sin eater, without whom a deceased person would go into the ground without having their sins absolved and thus spend their eternity in hell. Not to mention the social rejection their loved ones left behind would experience. The local sin eater, in doing his job, would also prevent the deceased soul from haunting the living, thereby performing a dual role to help the living and the dead. Let me explain further. When a loved one died, a family called for the sin eater to visit and placed a piece of bread or pastry on the deceased's chest for the sin eater to consume. The idea was any sins of the deceased accumulated in their lives would leach into the piece of bread or pastry, allowing complete absolution, and their soul was able to ascend into heaven. It did mean, however, and the sin eater was apparently okay with this, that the sin eater would take the deceased sin into his own body. With the mortality rate as it was, there was a lot of sin eating, and the absolution with the sin eater offering this prayer as he worked, and I quote, "I give easement and rest now to thee, dear man. Come not down the lanes of our meadows, and for thy peace I pawn my soul. Amen." You heard right, the sin eater would pawn, that's P-A-W-N, his eternal soul for the benefit of others. The sin eater took his work very seriously and took reference directly from the Bible. As Jesus Christ gave his life for others, this was the least a sin eater could do. I guess it was a calling to them, akin to a nun or a priest in the church. Another source states that it was a tradition from medieval times where the nobility would give food to the poor in exchange for prayers for a deceased person. Yet another source writes the sin eater concept may have come from hiring poor people to take on the sins of the dead in Herefordshire, England, while having heaped piles of bread on tables on November 2nd every year, which is All Souls' Day. However, the way a sin eater became a regular sight in the United Kingdom, being a sin eater was pretty hard work. Not only taking on the sins of the deceased, the pay rate wasn't that good. The average sin eater would partake in ale at the morning, have his bread or pastry, and receive the sins of the departed, and earn about fourpence, roughly worth only a few dollars today. The job also came with risk to life and limb. The Catholic Church decreed that sin eaters were doing a, well, sinful job, but because in their eyes the Church was the only ones who had the power to absolve sins, and decided that being a sin eater was a crime punishable by death, as it was heresy to take into one human hands something that could only be resolved spiritually by the clergy. People also thought that with every sin they ate, a sin eater was becoming more and more evil. So they were shunned in society and lived the life of a hermit out in the towns and villages. To look at a sin eater in the eyes was thought to bring bad luck, and while the role was somewhat respected, being a sin eater was also thought to be the work of black magic, another big no-no. Those families who were also seeking absolution for their loved ones by employing a sin eater were also seen as heretics. But how else were they going to get their loved ones into the kingdom of heaven? Richard Munslow, the last known sin eater, died in 1906 in Ratlinghope, a village in Shropshire, England, and he was said to have taken his sin eating job as a kindness to his neighbours and offered to absolve their sins, thereby reviving this practice in a more recent time. His grave fell into disrepair, and in the year 2000, the Reverend Norman Morris collected £1,000 from a grateful village to repair the grave and give thanks to Richard. It's unknown if anyone ate Richard's sins, but it gave something else to Richard, and his brethren as sin eaters a final recognition for their selfless work. The end.
Indeed.
Oh, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really feel for the sin eaters. I mean, they physically ate the bread or the pastry that was on the chest of someone to make that person's entry into the afterlife pleasant and peaceful, and to give reassurance to the people that this death was leaving behind, and to be shunned like that and to be told that you're a heretic and, you know, threats of death just for doing something that is seen as something to help people, I find that reprehensible. That's so bad. I really feel for these guys, and I really wanted to bring this one out because it's a very different sort of piece of what the. It's yeah. A what the. The whole thing is a what the. It was their calling.
It was. And when you think that at this time, I mean, there would have been so many people dying who couldn't get a priest to attend or quite often...
Because that costs money.
Yeah, quite often the local church charged too much for a priest to come and absolve the sins. You know, that's an area that people are going to step into and try to do things about.
And they saw a niche and in the market, as it was, and they filled it. And, yeah, kudos.
Indeed.
Kudos to the sin eaters.
Absolutely.
We much love you respect. Here. We much respect. We give you much respect.
Indeed we do.
Indeed. And you wanted a sin eater at your funeral, you were saying before.
Yeah, last time around I was saying that, I'd like a pretend sin eating happening, and then since I'm considering it anyway, but it's a science, the resurrection men can come and get me.
See how even, you know, we're thinking of, you know, making plans for the afterlife, that Trev even wants what the history subjects to be brought into it. I think that's
indeed
interesting.
I don't think the segue I had before is going to work.
No, God, no,
this time.
No.
So, shall we move on
from something that's a bit unhappy to something that was meant to be happy?
Yeah. Okay, that works.
Yeah. All right. I did a segue. Woo-hoo!
Segue, Susie.
Oh.
Doesn't sound good?
No.
Okay. Let's move on, shall we?
Yes.
When you think of amusement parks, it's difficult not to let your mind wander to the famous Disneyland, located in Anaheim, California, which is often hailed as the happiest place on Earth. The creator of Disneyland, Walt Disney, had long dreamed of creating the ultimate amusement park for families, but found many of the ones he visited a bit on the seedy side. He eventually travelled to Amsterdam in 1951 to visit the Tivoli Gardens Park in Copenhagen. Walt found this park to be clean, orderly, and best of all, had a nice family atmosphere. Reportedly, he explored the park, notebook in hand, writing down details about everything from the rides to the seats dotted around the gardens. In July of 1954, Walt confidently announced that his own park, Disneyland, would have a special invitation-only opening day on July 17th, 1955. Employees and contractors worked furiously on the park to try to ensure the opening, which was also to be televised, and they wanted to make sure it would be a fun, family-friendly affair. With special celebrity guests, including the likes of Sammy Davis Jr., Debbie Reynolds, Jerry Lewis, and even Frank Sinatra on board, how could the opening of Disneyland be anything but a star-studded spectacular? Well, buckle in, guys. This is definitely going to be a roller coaster of a ride. First up, 15,000 invitations had been sent out to select dignitaries, as well as Disneyland employees and their families. The tickets had also been allocated so that half of the attendees would attend in the morning, leaving the rest to enter in the afternoon, to ensure the park would not be too crowded. This would have been an excellent plan if entrepreneurial individuals hadn't decided to produce counterfeit tickets en masse. Over 28,000 managed to enter the park, and none of them were interested in making way for those who were to attend the afternoon session. There was even one small businessman who set up a ladder against a fence and charged people $5 each to climb into the park. The sheer mass of people heading to the park caused its own problems. The local freeways were not really built with such large amount of traffic in mind. Cars were backed up for 7 miles, or just over 11 kilometres, leaving people trapped in their cars for hours. Given the family atmosphere, there were a number of young kids with the usual young kid road trip reactions, leading to families having to discreetly relieve themselves by the side of the road and even in the Disneyland car park. So what about the lucky thousands who made their way into the park? What joys awaited them? It was very obvious much of the park was still being completed. Wet paint signs adorned many of the attractions, and a number of the promised rides were still under construction. For example, people attending were not able to ride Tomorrowland's Rocket to the Moon, which was intended to give people the thrill of the regular space travel that will be available for all in the distant future of 1986. You can only imagine what the queues would have been like for attractions that were open. Now, add to the fact it was an unusually hot day, with reported temperatures topping 100 degrees Fahrenheit, or over 37 degrees Celsius. It was so bad that the asphalt in the main street area was melting in the heat, leading to many of the female guests getting their high heels stuck as they tried to move through the crowd. Compounding the heat issue was a problem that an ongoing plumber strike had left Walt with an unfortunate dilemma. He had to decide between having all the water fountains working or having fully functional toilets. He decided on the latter, given guests would have access to concession stands selling water and soft drinks. Of course, he hadn't planned on all the gate crashes, and the stock of food and drinks sold out everywhere in the park before lunchtime. As for the rides that were running, well, many of them weren't running for long, with the likes of the Peter Pan flight and the submarine-based 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea breaking down. The Mark Twain River Cruise should have been more reliable, even considering the waterway hadn't been cleared of weeds, which was dealt with by the installing of signs with Latin-sounding plant names to make the pesky plants seem more exotic. The riverboat, which travelled on an unseen rail below the water, was overloaded with 500 people packed on board. The weight of the thrill-seeking throng caused the boat to come off its rail and sink into the muddy bed of the river. Suffering staff managed to get the boat literally back on track within about half an hour, but as soon as it made it to the end of the ride, the rush of people trying to disembark meant the boat tipped over, leading to passengers having to wade to shore. I guess the soggy guests may have been a little appreciative of the heat unless they were near Sleeping Beauty's castle. A gas leak caused more rides to be shut down, but that didn't prevent some people noticing the fire the leak caused emerging from the castle. This, at least, was quickly contained, and Walt had no idea of the incident until the following day. Now, if you remember back to the start of this tale, I mentioned that this entire shindig was being televised. Despite all these issues, the estimated at-home audience of 70 million were very much unaware of the chaos behind the scenes. Actor and future US President Ronald Reagan co-hosted with Ark Linkletter and Bob Cummings. This didn't mean all appeared in control for those watching. Technical issues plagued the production. Due to the overcrowding, guests kept tripping over cables and pulling out cords. Cues were mistimed, microphones were left live, and quite often the action cut to incorrect areas, leading to many being caught out unexpectedly. Most infamously, there was even a shot of Bob Cummings in a rather passionate embrace with a dancer. Ark Linkletter embraced the chaos, saying during the broadcast, quote, "This is not so much a show as it is a special event. The rehearsal went about the way you'd expect a rehearsal to go if you were covering three volcanoes all erupting at the same time and you didn't expect any of them. So from time to time, if I say we take you now by camera to the snapping crocodiles in Adventureland and instead someone presses the wrong button and we catch Irene Dunne adjusting her bustle on the Mark Twain, don't be too surprised." End quote. While things did settle down, there was some more teething problems for Disneyland over the next few weeks. A stagecoach ride in Frontierland was permanently closed when it was discovered it was prone to flip over if it got too top-heavy. And many of the cars in the Autopia ride were wrecked due to children enthusiastically crashing them into each other. The point of the ride was to help children learn about respectfully following road rules. Perhaps most alarmingly, a panther and tiger escaped from the Disneyland circus, leading to a furious fight between the fugitive felines right in the middle of Main Street. What the history?
Oh my God. The amount of times I've had to bite my lip or bite my tongue or just, you know, stop a laugh from escaping me during that. Oh, that was really hard going. Oh my God! Just, oh, the visuals I'm getting. The Mark Twain ride just go boop.
Yeah.
Oh God! I don't even want to know how they got that back on track. And that water would have been just, you know, a bit hot and manky. Oh.
And weedful.
God, that weeds. Oh no! And the tiger and the panther. Oh my God. What the hell? I'm surprised it wasn't shut down completely, but, you know, the happiest place on earth was not so happy.
Not on that
day. No.
No. And I can only imagine how much those counterfeit tickets cost.
Oh, my God. Oh, you know, people always find a loophole.
They do.
Yeah.
Or a ladder.
Or a ladder. $5 to get in. $5 would have been quite a lot of money.
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
Way back when.
Indeed.
Oh,
so,
jeez, what the... Yep.
So we hope you've enjoyed these bizarre bits of What the History. If you do want to know more, links to all our references are down in the podcast description, just down below. Or, of course, you can head to the Rufus Project Presents homepage, rufusproject.com, to find links to all our previous episodes and references, etc., along with all the other fine Rufus Project Present podcast productions. That was almost a tongue twister.
Sold it.
Now, if you, if we're talking about the website and stuff like that, of course, if you want to subscribe to any of our podcasts, all the links are available on that podcast site. Or we also highly recommend that you sign up with the Rufus Project Presents Patreon.
Yes, that would be lovely. And hello to all our beautiful patrons.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Vicky. Hello, Andre. Hello, Mark. Hello, Brett. Yes, they all paid to get a shout out, so
shout out ahoy! Hey, sister! Mwah, mwah. Vicky's my sister.
So not only can you get a shout out in one of the podcasts, you also get the podcast a few days earlier than everyone else, along with a heap of exclusive patron-only content.
That's right.
So definitely head to patreon.com/RufusProject for more information on becoming one of our awesome friends.
We love you. We love you, awesome friends.
We do indeed.
We love you, awesome nerds. I love Pitch Perfect. We are not sponsored by Pitch Perfect or any subsidiaries of same.
But if anyone wants to sponsor us, we're open to suggestions.
Oh, gosh. Yes. On that note.
Thank you again for listening, and we will be back as soon as possible in these crazy times.
Yes, and please everyone stay safe and happy and healthy, and love to all our friends in Victoria.
Indeed.
Please be safe, guys.
Indeed. And we shall return with two more bizarre bits of history to make you say,
What the history? Bye, everyone.
Farewell.